Five pillars of education for a new paradigm. I'm very happy to be able to discuss this with you. I thought I'd start with a couple of little stories about why I've been so frustrated about this topic in the past. About 10 or 15 years ago, when I was still teaching at Berkeley, I got a call from KQED, which is a very liberal station. I forget whether this was radio or television. And they said, would you be interested in talking about University of California and education? I said, oh boy, would I. Let's get into this. And they wanted me to talk about some minor detail about the organization of the university. And I was interested in a much broader topic because I had discovered that we were embedded in a really serious, you know what I was saying before about a race between education and catastrophe, and how education wasn't upholding its part of the race, it wasn't winning. So I stepped back a little bit and said, no, I'd like to look at the whole policy of the university itself. How does it relate to the people of California? They said, okay. And I said, actually, I would like to talk about the culture that we're embedded in the impact of the mass media. And they said, oh. And I said, you know what I'd really like to talk about is Western civilization. They said, we can't use you. And I realized that, when I went 25% bigger, they got 25% less interested until, I reached infinity and they reached zero. So this, I think, is emblematic of the fact that we've created a culture, a thought environment where we get absorbed in details and we can't step back and look at the big picture. And another example of that sheds a different kind of light. I was on a committee in the university hierarchy to discuss courses, programs, things like that. And I said, hey, I have a great idea, folks. Why don't we have a public forum on what is the purpose of education? Well, they turned out the lights, tiptoed out of the room, closed the door, and for 30 years, this is not an exaggeration. I do a lot of exaggerating, but this is not one of them. Almost everything I say is an exaggeration. That's an exaggeration. Everywhere I went in the university to try to create such a forum, I was met with blank stares. It was worse than no thank you. It was like nobody just said anything, okay? Pretend there wasn't any comment just made. And I think the reason that my colleagues who are, good, honest people could not come to grips with this question is that unconsciously they knew they had lost the purpose of education. And you see, you now have the University of North Dakota training people to carry out drone attacks, and you have the School of Americas, recently renamed WINSEC, in Fort Benning, Georgia, teaching torture. I think you've reached the absolute pit. This is the bottom. Education could not be more disoriented. The purpose of education is to enhance life and not to destroy it. And we have found it convenient and strategic to use the power of education to be against life and against love in the terms that Ian was just defining, where you're not interested in the well-being of others, on the contrary. So I'm going to talk about these five pillars, and hold on just one second, Scott. And what I'm going to do is, start each one with a quote or a story. And as I mentioned before, I'm not always going to be able to come down to a practical way of introducing this pillar into our education, so that's where I'd like to have a mutual conversation with you. Yeah, Scott.
I just wanted to ask if I could record your talk.
Well, I'm recording it, so it would be very unfair to me to say you couldn't record it. Yeah. So I'd like to begin the first pillar, the story about a student of mine. His name was Mallory Moser. A brilliant young woman. She took all my courses and actually contributed a collage to the Meta Center, which is now the theme of our website. And Mallory came from a very prestigious high school called Marin Academy, and she had been an absolutely spectacular soccer star in Marin Academy. And she kind of wasn't the type, you know, physical type, mental type. So I said to her one time, "Mallory, why were you so big into soccer?" And she said, "At Marin Academy, you were either into sports or you did hard drugs. And I didn't want to do hard drugs, I went into sports." So we talked about that for a while, why this was. These are privileged young people with everything going for them, and they're, you know, falling off the edge of society. And she said, "Well, it was very simple. All they did was teach us head, 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 you know, it was packing stuff into our head until we felt like we were going to burst. And you had to have more stuff in your head to compete with the next person, and you had to do something to contact another dimension of your being." And you can imagine my shock when I came across this very powerful quote from Swami Vivekananda. You maybe know who he is. He was the foremost disciple of Sri Ramakrishna in Bengal in the 19th century. And he came to this country the same year that Mahatma Gandhi went down to India. So it's like, you know, India sent out two emissaries in two directions with very similar messages. He came to the Parliament of Religions in Chicago in 1893 with a spectacular success, spent about 10 years on and off in the States. And at one point he said, "The trouble with you people in the West is that you educate for the head only. You do not do anything about the heart. That is only going to make you 10 times more greedy, and it will be the death of you." That's a very powerful statement, and I think it's exactly what we're experiencing right now. The greed has gone out of control, economies are imploding, and we do not have the energy, the confidence to tackle the biggest problems on the planet. And I think he spotted it. So you can imagine how I felt when I saw that quote and I remembered Mallory. And this is where I come up with the first pillar, which is probably the most important one, which is for education to be meaningful, it has to educate the whole person. So what does a whole person consist of? There's different formulas for this which are useful, but one simple one is we are mind, body, and spirit. There's almost everything we say will be partly relevant to this first pillar, but let me move on now so that I can, much as I love to hear myself talk, I would like to get more interactive as soon as we can. Second pillar, I'll begin with a story that's in my book, Search for a Nonviolent Future. When I was teaching nonviolence at Berkeley, which Tal taught and team taught with me, Mubarak Awad is a very good friend of mine who had been in the first Intifada in Palestine and been deported by Israel in, I think, 98. Even though I wrote to the Israeli ambassador and asked him please not to do that, for some reason he disregarded my advice. Mubarak told us some wonderful stories about the first uprising, first Intifada, which was more nonviolent than the second one. And they noticed something. He's a psychologist. And he noticed that all the participants, all the Palestinian youth, the Shabab, who are usually the source of the violence, you know, the young males between 18 and 25, it's no different from Palestine and East Oakland. They had had serious drug problems and other substance abuse problems. And those problems stopped when they joined the Intifada. So my second pillar is, before I mention that, just contrast the war on drugs and what a total failure it is. The second pillar is that we have to teach for the hierarchy of needs and not just for the lowest needs, which are the material fulfillment of food, clothing, shelter, and maybe some health care. What are those needs? Well, there's Maslow's hierarchy you're probably familiar with, and I have a colleague who is a recovering biology professor who went into peace studies, and she decided to study human nature instead of burying herself in the details, and quickly rendered herself unfit for service at the University of San Diego. But she came up with this model that our three needs are for autonomy, bonding, and meaning. There's an interesting tension between autonomy and bonding, which I'm going to talk about again in a little bit, that we need to be with one another, but we need to be a self, which is independent. Autonomy, bonding, and meaning. So what happened to these youth in the West Bank was the minute they had something meaningful to do, something that could engage their agency, they dropped these habits, which, you know, these are seriously addictive habits. And I've actually had people in the peace movement tell me that, you know, going down to Central America, facing violence every day, coming back to the States, phew, you know, you're sitting in Marin County drinking lattes, what do you want to do with your life now? I want to go back, because that experience was addictive, literally addictive. Now, as to, I want to point out one thing about these higher needs, like the need for meaning, the need for bonding, the need for respect, and things like that. In our nonviolence work, we quickly discovered that when you open yourself up to these higher needs, they have a remarkable characteristic, is that they are not finite resources. They are not exhaustible. The need for petroleum ties us to diminishing resources. That gets us into not just the destruction of the planet in the physical, ecological sense, but in the social sense, it locks us into competition and violence. Most of the really horrific wars that are going on right now are basically about a struggle for a limited finite resource. It basically comes from our image of ourselves as needing physical things to be gratified, to be fulfilled. But the minute you start looking at something like love or respect, you discover that not only are these things not exhaustible, they actually grow by use. So it's like a perpetual motion machine, kind of. You know, when I respect all of you, which, as it happens, I do, it doesn't mean... No, that one... Well, no, in this case, every single one of you... Maybe if I got to know you a little better, but... No, I can't. But in so doing, I don't diminish my own respect. I don't lose respect. Similarly, you know, as St. Teresa of Avila said, amor sacca amor. When you love, it draws love to you, and you grow in love, and you keep pushing to see how far this thing can be pushed till you reach the end, and you never reach the end. So there's a tremendous relief from the sense of need, the paradigm of scarcity, and the competition and the violence that comes along with that. Here I do have one experiment I can share with you. While I was teaching at Berkeley, they introduced these freshman seminars. And the thing about a freshman seminar is that you could teach it on any subject. So I asked myself, what do these freshmen, sophomore kids coming into Berkeley, what do they need more than anything which the university would not give them? And so I devised a course called Great Writing on the Meaning of Life. And I went into my chairman in the classics department, and I said, Don, I'm going to teach this course. I will involve a certain amount of Plato. He knew me very well by that time. He said, Michael, he said, go away. Don't tell me what you're going to do. Just go and do it, okay? And that was one of the most successful courses I ever taught. I taught, went on for 15 years, developed a regular syllabus of what you could read. And in that course, my goal was not to tell the students what I thought the purpose of life was, though inevitably that did happen at some point in the semester, but rather give them permission to think about it. Because in this world that's, you know, sucked up into these details, they never have permission to think about it. So we read people who had pondered this subject deeply. We discussed it together. They brought in their own experiences. They did very creative projects. One student came in. This, I think, is the one that stuck in my mind most. She made a batch of cookies. And it was an allegory. The dough stands for this. You know, the sugar stands for that. We all have to work together to create it. They're very good cookies. I've discovered one interesting thing that may be relevant for you also, that when I first taught it as a freshman seminar, it didn't work all that well. But when they added sophomore seminars, it was much more successful. Because I think the freshmen were too tentative about what are we doing here, and I got to find stuff out. I can't afford to do anything that's off the margins. Okay, now the third pillar. Stephanie and I went down to Birmingham, Alabama recently and spent two and a half days with a man who had spent 23 years of his life in very close association with Gandhiji, and that was Narayan Desai, whose father was Gandhi's secretary. And one of Gandhi's major efforts in his constructive program was called Nai Talim, which means new education. And so they started a school. They just found a building and invited the village kids. There's always a terrific need for this in India. And they brought these kids in. There were 60 kids in the school. And instead of telling us, you know, what the subjects were that you taught, he said, we discovered very soon that we had to end early in the afternoon. Because of those 60 kids, something like 45 of them had night blindness. That you had to stop school where there was still broad daylight for them to get back to the village, because come sunset, they couldn't see a thing. And they discovered that it took one cup of milk per day to cure those kids of night blindness. So my third pillar is that whatever we teach and however we teach it, it has to be grounded in reality. Be grounded, first of all, in concrete nutritional realities, but then open itself up to deeper realities. And in this developing new education, or Nai Talim, one of the things that Gandhi said was, if you do not till the soil, you will forget who you are. You will forget who you are. That every one of us has to be involved in some way with what he called bread labor. And the best way to do that was to have you tilling the earth and growing things that you yourself eat. You know, edible schoolyard is a very concrete way of instantiating this. And I would add a couple of other things that there are two things that we should try to avoid. One is we must avoid abstraction for its own sake, you know, intellectualization. What is it, that term that you use about me all the time? Conceptualization for its own sake. Because that leads to people sitting behind very clever machines and sending drones halfway around the world to kill people that they don't even see. I remember before there were drones, there was the Rand Corporation during the nuclear era. And they would sit around coldly, dispassionately calculating how many millions of people would die if we use this type of approach, and how many hundreds of millions would die if we use that type of approach, utterly disconnected with reality. And somehow we must educate people so that that cannot happen to them. Also, we want to... maybe I'll just share a really quick story with you here in connection with your identification of caring as a form of love. When I was in grade school in New York, you know, children can be incredibly uncaring. They have all these compassion is all within them, but they can be incredibly uncaring. And there was a girl in my class who was developmentally disabled. And I probably wouldn't have done this on my own. Do you know, as St. Augustine says, get people together in packs and all these barriers fall. You know, at home we have these deer that graze around on our meadow, and we've noticed that if one dog walks up the path, the deer don't pay any attention. But if two dogs come in, whew, they're gone. You know, because it is pack psychology. So I got together with some of my friends. I was probably the ringleader. And we teased this girl. We wrote a note that was disrespectful to her. The teacher intercepted that note, and I had never seen her so angry, and never saw her so angry again. And it was a big shock that awakened me to the caring, that in through her care for that person, I suddenly realized in a very shocking way what I had been doing, and was just never capable of doing that again. So that's one don't. We shouldn't develop, we shouldn't allow abstraction to go on for its own sake. The other don't is we should not allow intellectual development to separate us, to create a caste, which unfortunately is very, very common in today's educational system, where immediately they got to be subjected to testing, they got to be spread out on a spectrum, you know, who won, who was in the middle. And for this reason, Gandhi, for example, was constantly stressing the non-development of the intellectual life of peasants in the villages, that they had the same intellectual capacity that all of us do, but because they have to follow a bullock all day long, 7 days a week, in order to make ends meet, their intellect was never developed. Then you have these Brahmins who felt, you know, almost infinitely superior to them. So that's another thing that we have to avoid in getting students grounded in reality. Fourth, I'm going to start with a quote from one of my favorite philosophers, probably my second favorite philosopher from the ancient world, who is Epictetus. He was a Greek philosopher functioning in Rome. He had been a slave. In fact, the name means possession, object. And one of the very succinct, very powerful things Epictetus said was, "The beginning of all ignorance is the failure to connect particulars with their underlying principles." So now you might remember Goethe's Faust, who's, you know, suffering from a sense of emptiness, and he's willing to sell his soul to the devil in order to discover something which I would translate as the seeds and dynamic principles of reality, and stop this being a shopkeeper with words. Yeah. The quote from Epictetus, yeah. "The beginning of all ignorance is the failure to connect particulars with their underlying principles." Okay? Yeah. And so this failure, which has now reached very acute levels, is what leads to death by details. You know, anytime you read about an act of violence, it will tell you, you know, what caliber, where the bullets were ordered, and what color hair the shooter had, and you will be totally, totally discouraged from ever asking yourself, what is violence, why is it increasing, and what can we do about it? And of course, having taught at Berkeley, or studied or taught for close to half a century, I've watched this proliferation of subjects such that now education is now divided up into smaller and smaller silos, and we are losing touch with the basic principles of what education is for. And then when troublemakers like me come around and say, what is the purpose of education? It's completely shut out. So one way that I found is handy to get this across is, and you alluded to this a little bit, Virginia, earlier on, when I would start a course by saying, we have different capacities to learn, and knowledge is one, and this whole institution has been kind of oriented around that, but there's a deeper kind of knowing which we might call understanding. And then there's a deeper kind of knowing still, which we might call wisdom. And knowledge is where you accumulate facts, and this is on the level of information. And understanding is where you begin to detect patterns among these facts, and you can sort them out. You can say, oh, this was an act of violence. We should be thinking about it in those terms. And wisdom, finally, is where you begin to grasp the relevance of those patterns. You can relate to them personally. What does this mean to me? How shall I use it? And now, so in other words, information is the lowest form of knowledge. And you know, notice we have very proudly entered the information age. And people don't recognize the irony that's inherent there. If I had anything else I wanted to add to that. Yeah, nope. So I think we're doing well, time-wise at least. And I'd like to move on to the fifth column, quote unquote. I'm sorry, I never did tell you what that was. It was to try to cultivate deeper modes of knowing. This is not unlike saying teach for the whole person, because you know I have a capacity to memorize facts. I also have a capacity to understand how they fit together, and I have an understanding of how I have a capacity to judge what the meaning of it all is. Now, I'm not saying that we should not teach facts, but we should teach them in such a way that people, the students, can grasp underlying patterns and ask themselves, how does this relate to my challenge as a human being that has to live right now on this planet? And I've noticed we tend to polarize so much that when you talk about understanding or wisdom, people think you mean we're not going to teach facts anymore and students will be adrift in the world without knowing those facts. And so I think we should use facts as grist for understanding and ultimately for wisdom. So I haven't formulated that fourth column very well, but yeah.
Could I comment?
Sure.
I would encourage you, with all due respect, to not use the word try there, because in my experience,
not to use the word?
To use the word try.
Try.
There's almost this kind of subconscious acceptance that we can fall short of our own capacity when we use like if we tell our children to try to do something. It's almost like permission to not do your best. You know what I mean? I don't know if that makes sense.
I'm not sure I quite understand. I mean, what I'm talking about is encouraging.
Oh, I just meant if you're using that as the way you formulated number four, to cultivate deeper modes of knowing.
Okay. Well, that we can strike that word. You know, cultivate deeper modes of knowing. I like that.
Yeah.
Or else. Okay. The fifth column. And that is an unintentional pun. There is a story among the Bambuti pygmies, they're still called that, I think, in the Congo, about a time when the tribe was migrating from one part of their region to another, and a child was accidentally left behind. And it was a girl child, and she grew up. She survived all right in the jungle. She was an enfant sauvage. You know, she lived on her own in the forest. And that's okay, except she turned into a demoness. And if anybody went near her, she would seize upon that person and destroy that person some way. She would, I don't remember, but it was pretty nasty. Yeah, whatever, you know, became a cannibal or something like that, but it was a boogeyman story. You do not want to come across this person in a dark forest. Now, I taught mythology for many years, and for me, I always remember what I think Schopenhauer said, that a myth is something that never happened but is always true. And I think this story is about alienation. When someone is cut off from the community, either because the community has scapegoated them or for some other reason, they can survive, but they become a terrific danger to themselves and everybody else. And yet the one thing that the media will share with you that is not totally trivial, not completely irrelevant, is all of these psychopathic killers, they always tell you they were a loner. Just like this person. Ken, there's a place over there. I'm almost to the end of my spiel and we'll introduce you. And another angle I'd like to share with you, if you saw Amy Goodman's recent piece on gun control, it was entitled U.S. Gun Control Laws, Guilty by Reason of Insanity. So I was asking myself, why this insanity of we're now reaching a point where there are more guns than people in the United States, and of course with every single weapon that's added to the pool, we become less secure. And that's almost a mathematical proportion. So why are we doing this to ourselves? How could we be so crazy? And the only reason that I could think of is that each person, when he or she, though it's almost always he in this case, decides, I'm going to get a gun, is thinking of himself as completely isolated from the whole. So if I have a gun, I'll be safer, which actually is wrong. You know, if you have a gun in your home, you're 5 times more likely to shoot someone in your family than to shoot an intruder, and 20 times more likely to have that gun stolen by an intruder than anything else. Okay, but that the wrongness of this, on the statistical level, notwithstanding, the person is thinking, I, as an absolutely isolated fragment, will be enhanced in my security by this weapon. So the mistake there is in that first sentence. You are not an isolated fragment. That's why the logic of this thing goes so incredibly wrong. So the fifth column is that if a person is to emerge from our institutions or contact with us truly educated, he or she will need a grasp of the mystery of unity and diversity. And I'm trying to think of how you put this the other day, Nicole. We are a part, but we are also one. And the marvelous quote from Martin Luther King, which I like so very much, where he said, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be, and you cannot be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. So far from imagining the world as a place of competition, which through the misuse of Darwin we have done, we have to realize that all the separateness, the apparent separateness that we see, is really diversity. And as the Quran says, Allah says in the Quran, I made you separate people and tribes and individuals so that you could discover one another. So somehow we need our diversity to discover our unity. Those things are actually complementary. Diversity more or less on the surface of life, unity more or less on the heart level. So, Tom, this is why I got excited thinking about what's wrong about military camaraderie. And it's because in that kind of group community, the individual is expected to abolish him or herself for the group. Whereas if what Martin Luther King said is correct, and of course it is, you can only really contribute to the group by being yourself in the deepest sense. And I went through this when I was challenged as a conscientious objector. They said, what, you don't want to sacrifice yourself for the society, you don't want to add to society. I said, in order for me to add to society, I said to my draft board, they totally didn't get it, but I said it anyway. In order for me to add to society, I have to possess myself. I have to be who I am. The most important part of me is not my, you know, rather small body, but my conscience. And I can do you much greater service by recognizing something about the unity of life than I can by pretending I haven't seen that for your strategic purposes. So when we were beginning peace studies at Berkeley, I invited a colleague of mine who was an engineer to come in and give a lecture. And it was, for me, one of the biggest breakthroughs of almost of my whole intellectual career. He started off talking about, he put a lot of formulas on the board, so that my students were thoroughly terrified when he got to the point. And he said, okay, now why is it that these two fields, like biology and physics, started out almost simultaneously, and now physics has become one of the greatest intellectual achievements of humankind. You know, beyond Einstein, you know, quantum theory and string theory, incredible feats of human accomplishment on the intellectual level. And biology is just sort of limping along, you know, can we look at molecules now? No, they have no theory of life at all. I say this with all due respect to my dad, who was a biology teacher. Never mind, I don't want to start telling stories about my dad. So he said, okay, now what is the reason for this? He said, the reason is that in physics, we can study the universe in a model of uniformity, so that every single proton in the universe, and there's a lot of them out there, every single proton is exactly like every other one, except for their velocity and position, which anyway we can't talk about, thanks to Heisenberg. But in biology, diversity is the essence of biology. No single individual on this planet is exactly like any other. If they were, we would freak out. You know, in some tribes, they kill you if you're a twin, if you're an identical twin. So, and we do not have the conceptual framework to understand unity in diversity. So that's why physics has leapt ahead, but kind of gotten into a blind alley, whereas biology is almost trying to still get off the starting block. So I don't have any good ideas practically about how to do this, but I do feel very, very strongly that this is a need of our new paradigm education, is that students will have to grasp the mystery of how unity and diversity are complementary. I know the one thing that Gandhi suggested was, in the new educational system, every student would be exposed to a reverential study of all the world's religions. A reverential study, not just, you know, the way we used to teach it in religious studies. Oh, look at these interesting phenomena. How quaint. But more, what were our fellow human beings trying to get at with these models and these practices? And that in itself is a kind of unity and diversity, because you see the unity of aspiration throughout the human family, but expressed so very differently in different cultures. And here, again, to come close to the end with somebody that I started with, Swami Vivekananda, when he visited this country, he went to Harvard, and he was hosted by a classics professor at Harvard, which I partly was very proud of. But this classics professor, in an attempt to ingratiate himself with Swamiji, said, Swamiji, there's so much violence in the world because of these different religions. What we need is one religion for all of humanity. And Swami Vivekananda said, yuck, that is the worst idea I've ever heard of. What we really need is to go in the opposite direction. We need one religion for every individual on the planet. Because every single person has his or her initially unique way of approaching the real. As you get closer to the real, of course, that uniqueness is melded into a unity. I wanted to show you, to close with just a word about, well, two things really. I want to characterize very brief, succinctly, what's wrong with the old story and how the new story has to be different, and then talk just briefly about the regenerative capacity of education when it's done right. I think in the old story, or the old paradigm, basically human beings are treated as means to an end. We want you to grow up to be big, good citizens, to function successfully in a corporation so that you can make money for the state of California. I mean, believe it or not, if you go off on that highly prestigious campus, that great research university next door, I forget the name of it, they will tell you, implicitly or explicitly, this is what we're educating you for. And every time an administrator from the campus goes to argue with the state about why we should, why you should give us back our budget, it's because we make money for the state of California. So that's the old story. The new story comes from philosophers like Kant and Mahatma Gandhi, who said that a human being should never be a means to an end. And there was another Greek philosopher, my third favorite, who said, Anthropos ton metron panton, the human being, the individual, is the measure of all things, of things that exist, that they exist, of things that do not exist, that they do not exist. So a new paradigm is going to have to be more or totally Kantian, in that the student who comes in is to be regarded as a priceless resource to be developed and not a means to an end. And when we have at the Meta Center developed a project called Roadmap. You can get these brochures down below. It's becoming very successful. It's got its own tab on our website. And we divided the problems of the world into six wedges, and top dead center is the creation of a new story, the building of a new paradigm. And to education, the media, and research are the three parts. And just to close with a quick reference to the power of education when it's done right, we both had experiences recently of going into prisons and doing teaching there. And the program that I was part of, I was told that the rate of recidivism of men in that program, incidentally, these were 16 years to life, so these are mostly people who had killed one or more people. The rate of, you know, recommitting crimes after they got out of prison, if they got out, was 2%. The national average is 76%. So that saving of 74% recidivism, just because people came in and gave them the benefit of thinking that they had the capacity to learn. And that was a tremendously rehumanizing fact for them. And take this to an extreme degree, I don't know if any of you have seen this film, Doing Time, Doing Vipassana. People have brought meditation into prisons in India and have a tremendous restorative effect on the prisoners. And after all is said and done, meditation was called in ancient India Brahmavidya, which means the supreme education. Okay, so yes, Tom, stop here.
On that point about the new story, again, I reference the KQED, but Dylan Lisney's Bay Brian Swim.
Yes.
Brilliant one-hour documentary, and again, you can download it, and it's called Journey of the Universe.
Yeah.
Magnificent one-hour history of the universe accessible to everyone.
Yeah. I had a funny little story with Brian one time. We wanted to meet one another, so we arranged to meet in Tamales, and I sent him a magazine which had an article by me and a picture. And when Brian saw me, he said, oh yeah, I recognize you from your picture right away. Of course, Tamales is a small town, and you know, there's not like this crowds going back and forth on the sidewalk. But then we looked closely at the magazine, and they had swapped my picture with somebody else. So we saw something. Somehow he recognized me and attributed it to the picture, which was of a totally different person.
Meaningful.
Journey of the Universe, Brian Swim. It's SWIMME. It's a British swim.